Deutsche Welle, Spotlight on Europe.
Many thanks for joining us here on Spotlight on Europe. It's always a pleasure to have you on board as we take a look at major events here in Europe, but from an African perspective. My name is Jane Nyinge, and of course, we've got a lot lined up for you, including the worsening living conditions of refugees in Greece. And we'll also be in Spain taking a closer look at the political developments as the Spanish government considers the so-called nuclear option to end Catalonia's autonomy.
The most important thing about it is its symbolic value. It's been talked about so much. It's been seen as this nuclear option. The fact that finally it looks like it's going to be triggered is extremely significant, and it's kind of a reckoning for this whole crisis.
Well, for these stories and much more, please stick around for the next 30 minutes. We start off in Greece, where international aid agencies have raised concerns over what they termed as the worsening living conditions at state-run refugee camps. The situation is so bad that the cases of suicide attempts, self-harm, and psychotic episodes among refugees have increased by 50% in recent months. Anthi Karasava sent us this postcard from the capital, Athens.
Jane Grimes, an aid worker for the MSF charity group, could not be more blunt. Every day, she says, both she and her team of mental health experts treat patients who tell them they would rather have died in their country than remain trapped in Greece. MSF is just one of many agencies warning of a mental health emergency unfolding in five refugee centres in the Aegean. Housing conditions there are so awful that many people, including families, are being forced to sleep rough, aggravating mental distress for those already traumatized by war, conflict, and violence. On the sun-kissed Aegean island of Samos alone, more than 3,000 people lived in crammed facilities designed to hold no more than 700. Likewise, on the island of Lesbos, more than 5,000 asylum seekers live sardined in a filthy, boxy encampment. And with no space left for housing containers to be built, thousands now are being forced to live in the rough, in cheap and flimsy play tents. The conditions have refugees going mad. In a recent report published by MSF, the aid group says nearly three-quarters of new mental health patients examined there require treatment from a psychiatrist. That's up from just over a third recorded the previous 6 months. The need for action is urgent, experts warn, more so now as the end of the siege in Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq are pushing fresh flows of illegal migration to Greece. In a landmark deal last year, the EU and Turkey signed an agreement to halt the flow of more than 1 million mainly Syrian refugees flowing into Europe. While the number of arrivals to Greece has dropped dramatically since then, daily arrivals have surged in recent months, increasing inflows by 5 to 6 times. That means that an already agonizing wait of at least 6 to 8 months for political asylum could now turn suicidal. MSF says it's already counting a 50% rise in suicide attempts, self-harm, and psychotic episodes. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. As increasing downpours signal the start of winter, aid agencies here fear another fiasco to match the frozen misery of last year when 6 people died in sub-zero temperatures. In Lesbos alone, more than 1,500 people are living in makeshift shelters without heating and insulation. Most of these people include pregnant women, people with disabilities, babies, and toddlers. The United Nations Refugee Agency has been urging Greece to winterize refugee camps in the Aegean. No action, though, has been taken. Anthi Karasava, DW, in Athens.
Staying on the subject of migration, we move to Italy, and the tiny southern island of Lampedusa has seen thousands of migrants, women, men, and children seek safety there after a dangerous Mediterranean crossing. Many spend weeks lazing around waiting to be told their next move. That's why a group of librarians from around the world decided to offer those children a library of books that everyone can read. And as Megan Williams reports from Rome, those same books are now on display in Rome.
Storyteller and retired librarian Mariella Bertelli leads me to a low shelf lined with beautiful picture books, lying open in a small room off a crowded hall in Rome's Palazzo dell'Esposizione.
This is the Scaffale d'Arte, a bookshelf dedicated to books for children.
This unusual exhibit features dozens of what Bertelli and fellow librarians call borderless picture books. Some deal with migration, others, universal themes. She slowly turns the pages of one, the award-winning Footpath Flowers by author Giornarno Lawson and illustrator Sydney Smith.
A child is wearing a little red jacket.
The girl walks with her father in a black and white world until slowly she begins seeing things in color.
And so she finds flowers, and as she walks, she begins to...
What's missing from the book, in fact, from most of the books on display, are words. And that's intentional, because the books exhibited here are the same ones that are at the newly opened library on the tiny Italian island of Lampedusa, where thousands of migrants, including children, pass through each year.
Why wordless picture books? Because wordless picture books go beyond any barrier. Language barrier, age barrier, intelligence, IQ. They are meant for anybody to.
5 years ago, a group of tireless librarians from the International Board on Books for Young People, or EB, decided to create a library on Lampedusa. Deborah Soria, who owns a small children's bookstore in Rome, launched the project. That was after phoning the mayor of Lampedusa about donating books for migrant children.
She said, you know, there is 1,000 children here, they're Italian, but there's never been any library. And so I thought, wow, that's even worse. So the project started becoming a double project.
For migrant kids and for a community that's never had a library. She says art is a subtle, deep way to help migrant children talk about difficult feelings, something she's already seen on Lampedusa. It's also given some of the local teens, who play a key role in running the library, a new purpose.
I mean, it's very symbolic. We have to have a library in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's important that people know that stories are the connection between everything. And
a third collection of the silent books is traveling around the world after first stops in Canada, spreading stories of migration with quiet power. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
Well, if you've just joined us, this is Spotlight on Europe coming to you from Bonn, Germany. And yes, you can keep on talking to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa, or leave us a voice note on our WhatsApp. Moving on, the Spanish government has declared it will begin the process of suspending Catalonia's autonomy after it failed to respond to Madrid's ultimatum to formally set aside independence plans. The leader of the Catalonian region, Carles Puigdemont, declared independence after the referendum on October 1st, but immediately suspended the declaration, saying he wanted to talk with Madrid, triggering Article 155 to suspend Catalonia's autonomy. Would be the first time Spain has used the article in its constitution in 4 decades and represent a serious escalation of an already tense political crisis. Our correspondent Guy Hedgeco in Madrid has more, and he spoke to Emma Wallis.
There's a certain amount of mystery surrounding Article 155 because it has never been used in 4 decades of Spanish democracy. And even constitutional experts are slightly divided on how exactly it works. But the feeling is that it will allow Madrid to take at least partial or if not total control of Catalan institutions that the Catalan government currently controls. One obvious area would be the Catalan police force, the Mossos d'Esquadra, which the Spanish government is concerned that it is not totally loyal to the Spanish government, that its loyalties lie more with the Catalan authorities. Certainly that's been the case, it feels, over the last few weeks. That would be one area, for example, where it might take control. But it's going to take a few days for it to be implemented. It has to go, the triggering of the article is then followed by a debate in the Senate where the government needs a majority. It has a majority there, so that's not a problem. But it will take at least a few days for it to be implemented. And certainly it's expected to draw quite a big reaction from the Catalan independence movement.
Do you think that Madrid was hoping that by holding the possible triggering of the article over Catalonia, that they wouldn't actually have to use it?
I think there was an element of that possibly at the back of Mariano Rajoy's mind. I mean, so much of this crisis has been about sort of brinkmanship, one side moving slightly, then the other, big expectations ahead of announcements, and then those announcements turn out to be sort of rather more ambiguous or less strident than expected. I think on both sides, perhaps there was a hope that at the last minute there'd be some willingness from the other side to step back from the brink. I think Rajoy certainly seemed to think that that was a possibility with the Catalan government. He seemed to be giving them the benefit of the doubt, certainly before introducing this article. Many of his political allies in his party and in other parties had been lobbying for Article 155 to be applied several weeks ago or months ago. So in that sense, he has waited really until the last moment. But I think by the same token, the Catalan government has been constantly saying it wants to sit down and talk with the Spanish government, and it's, you know, it was willing to wait itself until the last moment for that to happen. But in both cases, it hasn't. So, you know, that in a way just reflects how entrenched these two sides are.
You talked about brinksmanship there and waiting until the last moment. How will Madrid's actions be seen this time? Will it be seen as coming in with all guns blazing and triggering this article? Or do most people in Spain think maybe it's fair enough since Catalonia has failed to meet the ultimatum set by Madrid?
Well, I think it certainly depends who you ask. I mean, interestingly, just a few weeks ago, there was some graffiti painted on the headquarters of the governing Popular Party in Madrid, Rajoy's Popular Party, asking him, telling him to trigger Article 155 immediately. So there is a sort of a section of Spanish society that wants him to take a hard line, certainly. I think in Catalonia, the Catalan independence movement sees this as very significant. In a way that the logistics of Article 155 are to an extent irrelevant, because I think almost the most important thing about it is its symbolic value. It's been talked about so much. It's been seen as this nuclear option. The fact that finally it looks like it's going to be triggered is extremely significant, and it's kind of a reckoning for this whole crisis. I think the Catalan independence movement see it as yet another red line being crossed by the Spanish government, and the Spanish government simply feels it's yet another reasonable step that it's taking to try and bring the Catalan government into line.
What about Carles Puigdemont? Do you think he's slightly regretting the actions since the referendum and that he kind of wishes that he could have done things differently?
Well, he has been in a very difficult situation. You have to take into account all the pressures that have been on him before and since the referendum. For one thing, he's had all these pressures from his own camp to push ahead with independence, this independence project that is so important to many Catalans, not all Catalans, but a large minority at the very least, to follow through on the result of the referendum, which according to the Catalan government favoured overwhelmingly independence. But on the other hand, there were pressures from the other side. Obviously, there was the threat of what the Spanish government might do implementing Article 155. There was also the financial threat. All these companies that have been moving their legal bases out of Catalonia over the last 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, there's around 700 companies that have done that now, simply because of the political situation. So that seemed to be a worry for him as well. So he's had to sort of walk the line between those two positions, trying to push ahead with the independence project, be true to his own supporters and to his own principles. He's a lifelong supporter of independence for Catalonia, and yet not being seen to be doing anything too reckless, not being seen to be too provocative, both politically and economically. And it's been a very difficult line for him to walk.
Where do the two sides go from here?
Well, I mean, they seem in a way as entrenched as ever. I think the Spanish government seems to be fairly determined to push ahead with Article 155. The fact that it's triggered it doesn't necessarily mean that it will be fully implemented, and we don't know the full extent of what that means yet. in a way, the ball is back in the Catalan government's court. It has to decide how it goes about now, following through on this roadmap to independence that it had laid out previously. I think we're probably going to see a lot of mobilisation of Catalan independence supporters out on the streets, a lot of demonstrations in Barcelona and other Catalan cities against Article 155, against the Spanish government. And the Catalan independence movement is very effective when it comes to mobilising people. And I think there's a feeling that in a way all of this, that this crisis, this saga, moves out of the institutions now and out onto the street. And I think that's probably what we're going to see going forward.
That was DW's Emma Wallis speaking to Guy Hedgeco in the Spanish capital, Madrid. Malta was shocked by a car bomb on Monday afternoon, which killed local journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was famous for being part of the so-called Panama Papers investigation and had been speaking out in newspapers and on her blog about corruption, politics, organized crime, and high finance for years. Her son Matthew, also an investigative journalist, was reported to have posted on Facebook this week that his mother was killed because she stood between the rule of law and those who sought to violate it. Paul Dallison is a British journalist who worked on Malta for several years alongside Daphne Caruana Galizia. He's now a news editor at Politico in Brussels, and he started by telling Emma Wallis what she was like as a person and as a journalist.
I knew her better as a journalist. She was a fearsome journalist. She had absolutely no fear at all about annoying everybody from both political sides. As a person, she actually could seem quite unflustered, despite the fact that she received a lot of threats, despite the fact that she was a very marked figure and everybody in the country had an opinion about her. I think she didn't always seem as if she had the weight of the world on her shoulders, which perhaps was you could have expected her to have.
So someone definitely with strong opinions and someone who was quite divisive. But when you were in Malta, did it seem like those kinds of opinions that Daphne held could get you into trouble?
I think they could get you into trouble. I mean, of course, nowhere near what happened. That came as such a big shock. But I think you could still get into trouble because it's such a small place. Politics is everywhere. It seeps into every pore. I mean, I once heard the expression that you're Labour or Nationalist, that's the two main parties, first, and then you're Maltese second. So everybody is aware of politics and everybody is very into politics and journalism. So I think having strong opinions could definitely get you into trouble. And I think Daphne definitely did get into a lot of trouble. She was being sued by pretty much every major politician. But obviously what happened in the end was such an unexpected escalation of that.
When you look at blogs like Daphne's, there's a picture painted of kind of endemic corruption on the island of Malta. Do you think that's an accurate picture?
There's certainly some truth to it. There is a lot of corruption there. It is a very new country. It's not been running its own affairs for too many decades. There is a lot of corruption there, not across the board, but there's certainly a small island like that. The chances of being completely disconnected from business interests, for example, are quite slim. There's so few people, everybody's connected to somebody else in another way. So I think that kind of amplifies the risk of corruption.
Do you think people will be more circumspect in their reporting now in Malta?
I think they will. I mean, Daphne was really one of a kind out there. I don't think there are other people whose work I'm aware of who are doing quite such adventurous or dangerous reporting, if you like. We ought to make it clear that she didn't have the same journalistic standards imposed on her when she was writing on her blog that other journalists have. She didn't have an editor saying, well, you can't say that, it's libelous. She would be happy to publish the fact that it was libelous. It would be okay for her. So I think the mainstream media will be a little more cautious, but I think it already was more cautious.
You're actually in Brussels. How are politicians responding there to news that a journalist in the EU can apparently be blown up for their work?
There's been a reaction of complete shock here. Obviously, the journalistic community is completely shocked. And the reaction from senior EU politicians has been the same. There's been across-the-board condemnation of this act and also, you know, support for the work of journalists across the EU. I think the fact that this has happened in a member state that, for example, held the presidency of the council until very recently has really kind of taken people aback here.
Paul Dallison, a British journalist now working as a news editor at Politico in Brussels. Now, Gartheim, a small Bavarian village that is home to less than 80 people, will soon become one of the most recognized locations in Europe. When the United Kingdom leaves the EU, the geographical center shifts to Gartheim, which is located here in Germany. A wooden post in the middle of a field marks the exact location at the moment, as Natalie Carney found out when she paid it a visit.
It's a grey day in the northwest of Bavaria with light showers. We're stood in the middle of a typical rapeseed field. I feel like I'm in the middle of nowhere, really, as random a setting as one can imagine. However, this unassuming location is about to get global recognition.
My name is Jürgen Götz. I am the first mayor of the municipality of Veitshöchheim.
The village of Gartheim, where this field is located, is so small that it falls under the jurisdiction of the neighboring town.
We are here in the middle of the field, principally at the new central point of the EU, which will be the central point after Brexit.
He began gesturing to what I thought was an insignificant rock on the path, but in fact, it's a significant marker.
We see here this border stone. Measured from this border stone, it will be 8 meters in this direction and then 13 meters into the field, where the new central point will be.
Aside from this rock, there's nothing there to indicate the soon-to-be center of Europe.
The municipality has leased the plot from the farmer who owns it, and we will erect an appropriate monument together with the local high school and the Bavarian organizations for wine and gardens.
A temporary marker was removed at harvest time by the farmer who owns the land. That farmer is Karen Kessler. Her family has owned the 55-hectare field for over 150 years and is thrilled that it will soon become the center of the European Union.
I was in the bakery in the neighboring town. The radio said Gartheim will have a new monument. One day later, my son sent me the coordinates. I looked at it and said, oh, that's on our neighbor's field. Then I came to the realization that, no, that's on our field. I had to laugh, and just like that, we will become the navel of the EU.
This is an historic moment.
Earlier this year, when Britain voted to leave the EU, the IGN Geographic Institute in Paris calculated that the new geographical center will move to Gartheim when the two-year divorce process concludes in April of 2019. Gartheim, with just a handful of houses, is a small, quiet village in the heart of the Bavarian wine region. With a population of only 89 people, it depends on farming. Yet, if the current geographical center of the EU is anything to go by, this sleepy village is about to see a potential new industry emerge, tourism. Westerngrund, some 60 kilometers northwest of Gartheim, became the geographical center when Croatia joined in 2013. Its mayor, Bridget Heim, opens a metal box containing a guest book. She says around 6,000 people from 93 different countries, some as far away as China and Mongolia, have signed it. Back in Gartheim, youngsters at the local bakery and training facility are hoping this focus will bring more support for youth programs in the area, says Julia Jering and her fellow student Angelina Andrastiko.
Gartheim is a very abgelegen Ort.
Gartheim is quite a remote place, and since it is the central point of the EU, there are already significantly more tourists. It's also good for young people, as it puts us more in the spotlight. Most don't know that this is a vocational training centre for young people with psychological and physical disabilities.
Yet Mayor Jürgen Götz says the conditions under which Gartheim gains this new recognition is not lost on everyone.
For me personally, it's a pity that Great Britain wants to leave the EU. I purposefully say want, because it is not yet clear that the negotiations will lead to a positive completion for Great Britain.
Karen Kessler seconds that.
I
think it's a pity. I would prefer it when another country would have joined. Now one country is bidding farewell.
The geographical center of the EU is a continually moving marker as countries come and go from the Union, with Macedonia, Serbia, Albania and Turkey all vying for entry into the EU. The center point may move even further east in the years to come. But the residents of Gadheim are okay with this, but they hope when they do lose their title, it'll be because a new member is joining, not another one exiting.
Super.
Natalie Carney for DW in Gadheim, Bavaria.
And now to our roundup of European news. And the EU has announced plans to combat so-called low-tech terrorism in public places. It has pledged more than 100 million euros to help towns and cities adapt open areas so that it is harder for terrorists to carry out attacks. Helen Sini has the details and this roundup of European news.
Barcelona, Paris, Nice, Berlin, London, Stockholm. Over the past couple of years, hundreds of people have been killed in terrorist attacks carried out in public spaces across Europe. In many cases, extremists have used vehicles to kill or maim, as well as knives. Now the EU is hoping to make these low-tech attacks more difficult. Measures include improving security barriers and advice on how to protect sports and cultural events. Brussels also wants to restrict access to substances used to make homemade bombs. And it's called for new techniques and training to tackle the problem of encrypted messages used by extremists to plot attacks. Criticism is mounting in Portugal over the government's handling of a series of deadly forest fires that have killed more than 100 people in 4 months. On Wednesday, the Interior Minister, Constanza Urbana de Sousa, bowed to increasing political pressure and handed in her resignation. Around 280,000 hectares of forest have been destroyed so far this year in the country's worst natural disaster in living memory. The government has been criticised for failing to develop a coherent strategy to fight fires and prevent new disasters. It now faces a no-confidence vote next week. Although the motion is unlikely to pass, public anger over the fires has weakened the government. A Swiss man accused of spying on German tax authorities has appeared in court in Frankfurt, charged with espionage. The 54-year-old, identified only as Daniel M., is alleged to have been sent to Germany by the Swiss government in order to find out who had provided secret financial data on a CD to the German state government of North Rhine-Westphalia in 2010. That state administration then used the information to crack down on German citizens concealing money in Swiss bank accounts to avoid paying taxes. North Rhine-Westphalia has spent nearly 18 million euros since 2010 to buy financial data and says it's recovered nearly 7 billion euros in tax revenues as a result. The Swiss government admitted in 2011 that its Federal Intelligence Service was involved with an investigation into stolen data, but declined to comment further on the case. Daniel M. is alleged to have carried out his spying activities between 2011 and 2015. After his alleged investigations, Switzerland issued arrest warrants for three North Rhine-Westphalian tax investigators for illegally obtaining banking data, which is protected under Switzerland's strict secrecy laws. But they're unlikely to face arrest unless they travel to Switzerland. France is planning to introduce new legislation aimed at fighting sexual violence and harassment. The new law will be voted on next year and will include on-the-spot fines for people harassing women in the streets or indulging in lecherous behaviour in public. A task force of five French parliamentarians from across the political spectrum is currently working to define harassment in a way that allows officers on the streets to enforce the law. Other parts of the legislation will lengthen the time women have to lodge sexual assault complaints going back to their childhood and establish the age at which a child can legally give consent to sexual acts.
Helen Sini with that roundup of European news. Well, that's where we end today's show. If you missed any bit of it or you want to listen again, visit our website at DW Africa or our Facebook page. On behalf of the entire team here in Bonn, Germany, my name is Jen Nyinge. Thank you so much for your time.